Welcome to the Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and we're thinking big picture about what public service means. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Brianna Clark Schwalm. Brianna is the executive director of the North Carolina Global Health Alliance, a nonprofit organization striving to advance the state as a center of global health. With a master's of public health and global health, Brianna spent the majority of her career focusing on improving access to care for women and rural communities, both in North Carolina and in some of the most remote communities around the world. She's lived and worked in Central America, East Africa, New York City, and her adopted home state of North Carolina. So Brianna, as a fellow adoptee of North Carolina, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to chat with you today.
I'm excited to chat with you for so many reasons, including the fact that we have a lot of things in common, which we've just gone over, like the fact that we are extremely type A and over-prepared for this episode. So I hope everybody enjoys it.
Yes, I never left school behind. I just work in my job.
I gave you an assignment and you completed it. It's an A+.
Did I get an A? Thank you. That's what I wanted. Yeah. I wanted an A+.
There's that approval. So you've got it. So the way we always begin is talking about where you come from and how your childhood might have influenced you to kind of pursue this path of service. Because for so many people, it's not just about the job. It's a calling and way of life. So where did you grow up? Who raised you? And what mattered in your home?
This is such a good question, and one that we as adults who are working are really asked. I feel like the last time I really had to think about this was maybe in my graduate school application. Like, what's the foundation of your mission? Why? What launched you into this? And it really does, for so many of us, go back to our childhoods, how we were raised, our parents, the values that were instilled in us. I'm from sort of split childhood between a really rural community in Maryland, where I literally lived in the woods. Like, my mom would open the door, I'm one of five kids, and five of us, probably barefooted, would just like run out into the woods. And that's what we did. And it was...
That is so wholesome.
Truly. And I mean, we had a treehouse, like there was a creek, we played all these outdoor games. It was amazing. And I'm the fourth out of five. And so I just followed my brothers and sisters all around. And I know that that really, it taught me a lot about, I mean, gosh, like freedom, but also I love rural communities because that's where I was born. Like, you had to drive really far to get to the doctor. You had to drive really far to get groceries. The only store that we had was Kmart and are there Kmart's?
I don't know, but I grew up with Kmart's too, so I feel
you. But like, you know, that and a secondhand thrift store. Right. And then when I was a little bit older, my parents decided they basically sacrificed everything so that we could go to a better school system. And they moved us to Connecticut. A couple jumps along the way, and then we ended up in Connecticut, and I spent the second half of my childhood in the suburbs. So I really had these dual American experiences of like wild child in the woods in the middle of nowhere and really suburban, like, we didn't have a white picket fence, but there were white picket fences.
And it's so funny that you actually told me that you're the fourth out of five, because when I ask people the childhood question, the other question that I could ask and kind of want to ask is, tell me where you are in the birth order in your family and what's your sign, and then I can just analyze you to like as much as I want.
I'm a Gemini.
Oh my god. Okay.
In a very real way. And I'm number four, two older sisters, older brother, little brother. These are, especially my siblings, being one of five, having two brothers, having two sisters, being one of the babies, that experience defined me. Absolutely. Yeah. More than anything else. It was the greatest gift that my parents gave us, was having siblings.
Yeah. And I feel like those relationships are the first experiences that you have with navigating conflict and figuring out like what you want your role to be in the world, and how you take all the raw material you were given and kind of like make yourself the person that you want to be and move through life the way you want to move through life. And I think about that so much because I'm one of three and I have three kids. And I feel like the work that I do, the diplomatic work that I do between my kids, might be the most tangible and impactful thing that I do for the world, because I'm trying to teach them how to move through life and navigate conflict and be true to themselves and be resilient and kind and all these good things. And so, I don't know. I feel like getting back to what service means kind of in the context of a family is huge and has become a big part of the conversations that I'm having with people on this show.
Yeah. I love that. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're an only child or you're one of 10.
Right.
Your position in the world is so framed by your experience as a sibling or not a sibling. I mean, I have a lot of friends who are only children who they were able to navigate such adult situations so much earlier than I was because they just had that right. skill already. And we all do it differently, but you're absolutely right. If we, I mean, this is therapy 101, right? Like in the family and
right.
how those relationships have impacted how you then see and treat the world. I am such a, I'm not like a soft, gentle caretaker, but I am someone who I would like to be. That's a goal. I think I'm someone who wants to make other people comfortable. Like
yeah.
I will go out of my way to make sure everyone in the room is comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I all my best friends are really introverted. My husband is really introverted. My family is really introverted. I'm not. I seek out the person who is so clearly uncomfortable in any social setting. And I like,
yeah.
I try to be with them. I know that is because I would look at my siblings and how they were interacting and the conflicts they had or the spaces we were in. And I was always sort of interjecting myself in places to try to like, just, you know, get rid of the tension or help my two sisters stop fighting. They were always fighting and I was always like, don't fight.
Yeah.
I navigate the world that way. And I know that my childhood influenced that.
And whether or not you think of yourself as like the caretaker, you certainly were taking care of things. So
I think that, you know, we'll talk about my current job. It's so fascinating to me that I have the role I have because in many ways I'm sort of like the hostess, the hostess of global health in North Carolina. Like I'm sort of like a party planner. And that's really my, over the course of my lifetime, I have loved hosting spaces. I have loved going through the process of curating an environment, really creating an ethos that is warm and welcoming and that allows any person who comes through the door to feel like it's theirs. That is the work I put into in creating spaces. And yeah, I think that it's a different kind of caretaker definition, but that's how I try to like give whatever skill sets I have, that's what I'm leveraging.
And it's also the unseen work and sometimes the underappreciated work of just like laying the foundation and creating the space where people can show up and be safe and learn and grow.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for doing it.
I appreciate that. You know, it's funny because I think that's what public health is, right? I think there's so many great quotes about how you don't know what public health is until it's not working, right? Public health is the invisible work. And that's what you and I do, whether global health, public health, or, you know, international diplomacy, all of these things are systems that work on behalf of people to keep us safe and healthy. And when you're safe and healthy, you don't know that someone's doing that. We're actually curating those environments.
Right. Yeah. And it is so easy for all of us to take these things for granted when they're working.
Yeah.
So let's back up to how you got to where you are today. Tell me more about, you studied religion at Bucknell University, and then you went to pursue a master's in public health at Harvard. What happened? Like, how did you connect these two things? What's the story there?
Well, first of all, shout out to humanities. I just love talking to undergraduate students who are studying English or the classics or religious studies. Like, shout out religious studies majors. We are few and far between, and I really am so grateful for the undergraduate degree that I pursued. It was a little bit random for me in actually choosing it, but it was the right course. And I grew up going to church. I grew up really active in my church. So I didn't ever want to be like a religious leader, but I was really interested in how religion helped shape and define our politics. And, you know, if you look at history, you cannot study history without studying religion.
Of course. Determined.
The divisions that we create in our societies are so often, if not based on religious differences, they are, you know, there's a strong interconnection there. And over my 4 years, what I came out on the other side believing was that we are actually all, we all believe a lot more of the same stuff than not. Like we are much more similar across all these different cultures and values and systems and religious doctrine. You know, there are so many similarities. Even, gosh, I encourage everyone to go read like mythology from different cultures. It's wild to me how many cultures have stories about like Noah and the Ark, that yeah. story of a flood that exists in so many cultures. There are so many stories that you see replicated across languages. I could go down this rabbit hole forever, but it gave me this foundation and appreciation for diversity of thought and interconnectedness. And I was already really interested in health. I knew I didn't want to be a doctor. I think a lot of people in public health sort of have that line of, I care about health, but I don't want to be a doctor. I don't really know what the space is for me to help improve health in right. some other way. And religious studies, and I studied abroad for a year. I went to West Africa. I went to East Africa. And those experiences sort of opened up, I don't know, this way of thinking that, oh, there's a big world out there. And I actually have a role to play in that big world. And yeah, it was a little meandering. I went to first Honduras, then Panama after undergraduate, and I worked in health yeah. centers, rural communities. Most of my career in practice has been working and serving rural communities, which obviously I spoke about that. Like yeah. I feel deeply about serving and being in community and rural spaces. I moved to New York City, the antithesis of what it means to be rural, which was a good experience for me, having never lived in a city like that. I lived there for about 5 years, and that experience of being in sort of a broader international development space, because I was working for an organization that had integrated programming, it actually sort of narrowed my scope in some ways. By working across so many program areas, I was like, oh, I actually do want to work in health. You as an individual see health as the foundation on which everything else rests. And I just knew if I wanted to see more women leaders, if I want that and I want to work towards a world where women have those opportunities, women need access to healthcare. They need healthy births, they need healthy babies. Like, women don't have time, quite literally do not have time to run for office or run your microfinance program if they're taking care of sick elderly people who don't have access to care, if they're giving birth every single year. I mean, women, they're carrying water because they don't have access to clean water. Like, going into global health for me after, you know, this foundation of religious studies and then having this broader experience of international development, it seemed like the answer to all of the questions of why do we have all these problems?
Yeah, but you arrived at it like through some searching and some I don't want to say trial and error, but like you have to explore so many different things, sometimes just to reinforce what you already felt early on. And I really like what you said about religion and politics. I think of them sort of as two sides of the same coin, especially in studying history, because I've always been interested in like, how do people organize themselves and how do we make that better so that more people are served by that organization? And so I think those have been throughout history kind of the answers to that question. And that's also why I minored in philosophy, political philosophy, and I loved it. And like, that's something I actually continue to draw from because it's all about asking the right questions, right?
Can I tell you, in my undergrad, I took philosophy thinking that, oh, this will align with all the other humanities classes.
Yeah.
It was the one class that I won't say I got a C in, but I didn't do well in.
Does it kill you to say that?
On like our major paper, I'm pretty sure. So yeah, for everyone out there, you can do poorly in something that you think you're going to be good at and overcome.
Yeah, you can. Also, okay, so I nearly failed Bio 101, which was a requirement. Mm-hmm. I took it at Carolina, and the professor literally called me into her office to say, like, you seem pretty smart. What's wrong with you? Like, why are you failing this class? And I'm like, because I hate it so much.
I felt about philosophy. I hated it. And I couldn't understand why everyone was speaking. This does not make me look good. It felt really abstract. And I think I was studying religion. It felt like religious studies and philosophy should be connected. But I was actually studying religious studies in a way that was really practical. Like, I'm really interested in the tangible. Like, why are we how are we moving through the world and why? What is motivating our behavior?
Yeah.
What are the belief structures that actually influence these decisions? And then philosophy, which I know that there are people out there who can translate it to the like practical, but I couldn't do it. I couldn't translate it to the practical. It made no sense to me.
No, but this actually makes complete sense then, because you were focused on the tangible and you've always been looking for like what is useful and practical about what you're learning. And we'll get there. But you have created a career that is so practical in terms of like meeting the needs of people, identifying what they are and doing it really well. And I, as a budding philosopher, now have a podcast. So honestly, we're doing exactly what we're meant to be doing. But I want to get a little bit into your career by way of asking you, well, first of all, you talked a little bit about how, like, you've wanted to be a champion of women's leadership and how you saw health as kind of like the root of doing that and also creating better lives and more opportunities for all people. So then when you moved into that career, what was kind of one of the most difficult things that you've encountered, and what's also been one of the most rewarding in personal life, actually, or in your career?
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about becoming a mom and like the challenges and great things that it's taught me. But this actually is making me think of something else that you and I haven't really discussed, which is in my early days, I really was really motivated by women's rights and the inequalities that I saw in the world, you know, that women, the barriers women faced to equality and the lack of opportunities. And I knew that in some way I was going to work in that world. I didn't know how. And then before this job, so I'm now the executive director of the North Carolina Global Health Alliance. Right before this,
I actually, snaps for that.
Thank you. Thanks.
That's very cool.
I'm very proud to be. I mean, I consider myself a steward of this community, and like I'm deeply proud of this work and this organization and this community. I'm also deeply proud of the chapters that I had before. Right before this, I was home for a year, which we can talk about. I took care of my babies. That is no joke. That is really hard. But right before that, the work that I did in North Carolina for the longest chapter or longest period of time in North Carolina was in domestic and sexual violence. And, you know, that obviously really closely aligns with my values for public health and, you know, the challenges around, you know, for women, to try to make the world a safer, healthier, more accessible place for women. When you talk about domestic and sexual violence, there's a very clear connection there. I see that as deeply connected to my overall mission. And what that experience taught me, I was there for, I don't know, a little under 5 years, was that I had had a limited understanding of the people on the planet who I needed to be in service of. And so,
interesting.
And I say that because I oversaw a team that worked in prevention for youth. And one of the areas that they really focused on was serving LGBTQ plus students. And I worked with the LGBT Center of Raleigh, and I think I've really shifted in my understanding of, like, if I want to serve women, I have to serve LGBTQ people. Like, they're, the freedom and the opportunities for these marginalized communities are so intertwined, and that you know, wonderful phrase that people pull from, the, like, none of us are free unless all of us are free. I saw that so clearly in the work of domestic and sexual violence, that if queer people are not safe, no one is safe. We have to serve trans people. We have to serve queer people from all identities and all backgrounds. Like, I cannot possibly have a mission to make this world a healthier, safer place if I am excluding this other, this community that, first of all, is so deeply intertwined, but also whose very freedom is interconnected with the freedom that women are looking to, you know, create.
Yeah. And like, the, since we're talking famous quotes, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. That's one of my favorite quotes, and it never goes out of style, unfortunately, because we haven't mastered justice yet.
We want to ensure that people of all identities, of all genders, of all backgrounds, walk into spaces and know that they belong there and that they are valued. And in my service of folks who have not always been at the table and have not always been included in these conversations, or who have not always been served equitably, it doesn't come at an expense to men.
Right?
Men, this is a big pie or a big table. My table only gets bigger.
And I think we all, it's everyone's mission to figure out, what are my talents? What am I good at? And then how do I help out with the piece that really resonates most with me? And so for you, like, it's really been this space of health as like the foundation for a good life and an equal shot at building a beautiful life. You mentioned that you were going to talk about carrying and giving birth to your children, twins. I really want to talk about that, because as a mom, we always want to trade our war stories, but like, I really do want to hear about how that influenced your evolution kind of on your journey?
I'll be honest, I never wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. Mm. I did not go into parenthood thinking this is the thing that will define me and all my dreams have come true. I like that really was not my experience. I wanted to have my kids, and it was radically different than what I expected. It was also very challenging after my first, which was peak COVID. So we were very isolated. I call it my invisible pregnancy because my mom didn't even see me pregnant. My first pregnancy, this like transformative experience, no one saw me. It was very bizarre. And which I think set me up for kind of failure. I experienced postpartum depression after my first, which was just incredibly challenging. I encourage anyone who is I wasn't diagnosed for many, many weeks. It was not at that 6-week mark when you go in and they ask you all the questions. I was not diagnosed at that time. It was, I think, maybe 3 months after I gave birth that I received my diagnosis, and then like went into therapy, and I was working at the time. And luckily, you know, I had that support going into my second pregnancy, which was with twins. But then, so then I was like more emotionally ready for the pregnancy, but then it was twins. And so physically, it was the hardest experience of my entire life, and that added its own emotional burden. And my transformation into parenthood, I was working in domestic and sexual violence. The vicarious trauma from that work is really challenging. And I went through that with my first pregnancy. I couldn't do it with my second. So I left my work, and then I found out it was twins. And so it was really good that I left my work because I ended up not really, I gave birth in October. By July, I was basically incapacitated. Yeah. Like I couldn't do anything. I was so big. It was very hard. And then I was unemployed for 6 months after. So I had a full year home with my babies. And, you know, I linger often on what those challenges were. I also want to reflect on just how like more focused I am as a person. I think because I've been in the trenches with my children, and I've experienced what it's like to also be a stay-at-home parent, which is so challenging. It is so, you don't have.
And it is a reality for so many people.
So many, whether you choose it or don't choose it, or it's thrust upon you. And mine was a little bit thrust upon me, a little bit chosen, like that middle space where we thought I was going to be going back to work. And then ultimately that was not an option. And, you know, I just have so much respect for parents who choose to stay home with their kids because it is a really rich experience. It also did show me that I did want to be in the formal working world, because that's the working world, but where you're paid and have colleagues who speak in complete sentences. And I, important to me, I wanted to get back in the game. And, and that, you know, even that process was really hard. And I'm grateful I did it. I have a lot of respect for people who do it for longer periods of time. I don't know. It's a challenging period for me to reflect on, to be honest. I mean, my twins are 2.5. My older son is 4.5. And I still get emotional. Like if I go too deep into it, even now, I'm quite emotional about who I was and the experiences that I had. And it's hard.
I talk about my motherhood experience in connection with my career because I've always viewed them as like all part of the same project of my life. But I do think it's hard to describe, right?
I love that you just called your life a project. I think that way too. Again, we're like type A plus students. I'm managing it. I am so
literally, I have to interrupt you to tell you when you said it's a project we're managing, my husband and I literally had a board meeting to talk about our family. So we're really taking it to the next level. Go on.
My husband and I actually just had a meeting yesterday as well. He came home to work so that we could have a meeting. And y'all, if you aren't doing meetings with your partner, it's really important.
It is. Go on.
there are a couple things you said I think are so interesting. First of all, like, just kudos, because I don't know how honored you feel by like the world or how recognized you feel. I felt really unrecognized for the labor that I was doing. And it felt a little like society was really pushing me to do this and then simultaneously gave me no credit for it. And it was like, of course you have to take care of your kids in isolation and, you know, be a perfect mother and do all these things without any support systems. And, you know, I struggled with that the whole time. I wish I had known I was only going to have a year, because whole time, instead of saying, I'm doing this for a year and I'm going to just be in it. I'm going to, mm-hmm. and I tried to be in it, but instead of really just being in it, I was questioning my identity and my worth and value and like what I was going to do next the whole time. Way before I was ready, I started like casually putting applications out there and like having some conversations way before it was the right thing for my family. Okay. And unfortunately, a lot of those conversations, those early ones, they were the kind where the people I was talking to didn't see my being a young mother as an asset. And so that just put me into a deeper state of like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to add value, despite the fact that the thing I was doing was what, talking back to what you were talking about earlier, helping my children be the best possible versions of themselves is the best thing I can do for the planet. That's the best thing that I can do
100%. As a human being. But you're right. A lot of women, I think, and I'm sure men too, when we're out of work, are like so focused on how long is it going to be? How am I going to explain this when I'm applying for things in the future?
Yeah, I totally hear you. I love my job. I really want to keep it for as long as I can. And I'm keenly aware that I, you know, one of the aspects of my role that I love so much is that I have a lot of flexibility and I have a lot of support from like my board, my community as a mom. That I've never had to hide that. And it's really hard to say that to people, especially working women or working parents who might be coming back from, you know, being home with their kids and are looking to make that transition, because I did have conversations with people where it was clear to me that my having little babies was, they were like, oh, we don't know if we can take that risk. Right? And finding an employer and an organization and a community that heard that I had little babies and that I'd taken a year to be with them and the skills that I had that I could adapt from that, because you gain skills, right?
Oh, like, yeah.
A way better worker quite quickly by managing little humans and managing yourself with
you are the CEO.
CEO of everything. Also, you're somehow also the lowest person on the totem pole. Simultaneously, it's very humbling. But you know, I do feel really I don't know. It's sad to me. It breaks my heart that I feel lucky to have a community that supports me as a mom. That shouldn't be luck, right? That should be universal, especially in a country that predicates itself on family values, right?
Totally. Like,
if that is something that we as a society are going to say is important to us, then women like us and parents in general, people who decide to take care of their families when their families need them, should be able to step back into the formal paid economy with only support, with only flexibility, with only belief that they can do it. And having other people believe that I could do it helped me believe that I could do it.
1,000%. I see here that you were on Medicaid when you delivered your twins and recovered from that. You're a Harvard grad who is now executive director of a nonprofit, and like you still had to rely on that social safety net. So when we talk about our country, our community taking care of women, tell me a little bit more about that. And then lead me into your work with NC Global Health Alliance.
Sure. Yeah, I think my Medicaid story is it's more common than people realize.
Because people don't talk about it.
People do not talk about it. There's so much stigma. I felt that stigma. I was deeply ashamed when we qualified for Medicaid. My husband and I have been working our whole lives. He worked while I was unemployed, but he's everyone's word of the day. My husband is a luthier. He's amazing. He restores string instruments. So
I have never heard that word in my life.
Luthier.
Cool.
Yes. Now you all have a new vocab word.
Yeah.
He's incredible. I mean, he's like he's a classically trained violinist. He studied music composition. He works with his hands restoring these beautiful 200-300-year-old instruments, and he's incredible at it. He's so skilled. And also, you know, that's a hardworking person who in America is not going to be making the same amount of money as an investment banker. And that's the way the system works. And so, and also there are a lot of really hardworking people who are experts in their space who are never going to be rich. That's just the end of sentence, right?
Yes.
And so we had saved, we had prepared, we made, you know, I had to leave my work my husband, or I, you know, I wasn't able to find new work when I was pregnant. My husband continued working, and still we qualified for Medicaid because the world is expensive. And yes, we did everything that we could. We tried to do everything right. And I think we did do everything right. And still we had two babies at once that mm-hmm. made our family go from three people to five people within 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so when I, and my, both of my twins, because I delivered at 36 weeks, they both went into the NICU.
Yeah.
And I had already been to the hospital before that. I mean, it was complicated. And mm-hmm. then, and then we had a complicated delivery, an emergency C-section, NICU for both of them.
Oh my gosh.
I had to go back to the ER the following week because of complications. You know, all of these things, like, we all know the stories of people yeah. going into medical debt in America. That is not cheap. All
no,
of
and it, you can do everything right, and it can happen to anyone. Right.
It can happen to anyone. That my story is one of just like you put all of your ducks in a row, and then someone just comes by, fate or God mm-hmm. or grandmothers or whoever, just knocks all those ducks out because they don't care. Like yeah. that is not how my my delivery story was what it was, and we were very fortunate that in North Carolina I qualified for Medicaid. And so at that time, when I was recovering from my very complicated delivery, two babies who then got COVID immediately.
Oh my gosh. That was like, that's like one of my biggest fears.
It was horrible. I mean, so many lung issues. One of my son was, I mean, we were staying up all night, every night. I'm recovering with the little nebulizer for him.
Tiny. I had a newborn with RSV and it was really scary. I get that. Uh-oh. Like, I think I was awake for a week.
Yes. Those 6-pound babies and doing a nebulizer to their little faces. Truly traumatizing experience for everyone involved. But I like to think that, yes, we did everything right. We still ended up in a situation where we needed help. We got the help we needed. And because we got that help, my family didn't go into the medical debt that we could very easily have gone into. Yeah. And so I was able to focus on my babies, take care of my children, stay home with them for the full 6 months that I really needed to stay home to recover. But really what I was able to do was wait until the right job came to me, and I was able to go for this job. And the only reason that I was able to wait that 6 months for this job was because we didn't have that debt. Yeah. And if we had that debt, I would have had to get a job immediately. Yeah. I would have had to, like, because we have bills. We're like everyone else. Most Americans do not have huge savings accounts to keep them afloat at times like this.
Yeah, and if we're about families, you were also able to, like, give your babies a great start, all the support, all of your like energy at that time, rather than, you know, having to choose something else based on necessity that maybe wouldn't have been the best for them or for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so then you ended up at this amazing job with North Carolina Global Health Alliance.
Yeah.
And you guys do great work. If you can give me kind of like the elevator pitch, but then I really want you to share with us how the organization's been impacted by the federal funding cuts as well.
Yeah. In the last 5 minutes, let's talk about funding cuts.
You know, I've already accepted we're blowing past. We can't help it. Like, we just have too many things to say.
No,
it's
too easy to chat with you. Yes, the North Carolina Global Health Alliance. So I moved to North Carolina in 2017 with a master's in public health in global health, and I did not know there were global health jobs in this state. I didn't know that. I ended up working for the NCDHHS, working in domestic public health, in rural health. I worked in domestic and sexual violence. And it wasn't until years later that I realized that North Carolina is rich with global health expertise, right? Yeah. This state is just like you throw a stone and you hit someone who's working in another country. It's incredible and very inspiring. And the organization that I run, the North Carolina Global Health Alliance, it was founded by those global health institutions to advance the state as a center of global health. We know, like, the people in it here know that North Carolina is a center of global health, but somehow other people don't really know that. And so I think of my job as sort of twofold. I try to invest internally into who and what we are here, and I try to invest externally to ensure that other people know who and what we are.
Yeah.
So internally, like I said before, I'm like the hostess with the mostest. I create spaces for people to connect with one another. I host a conference. I host roundtables and networking events. And it's a lot, you know, in some ways it's very fun. Also, our state is so connected.
Yeah.
People really know each other. And I know that my organization, which has been around for almost 20 years, has had a big hand in that, has had a deep influence in sparking new partnerships and collaborations. And there are real organizations and partnerships and programs that exist in North Carolina because our organization hosted a space and these people met and we helped curate these relationships and you know, facilitate that. And that's so meaningful. I mean, our ecosystem here is just really interconnected, and
right.
the Alliance has had a big hand in that. Externally, I also try to lift up the message that we are here, we are meaningful, and North Carolinians should be proud of that. So I work with our elected representatives and I continuously educate them. I might have to do a little bit more education recently than I did in the past, but educate them to make sure they know that this is a $32 billion industry in our state.
Yeah.
That's no small potatoes.
Yeah.
We are 50,000 people strong just in the global health sector in North Carolina. So that's a lot of jobs. That's a huge economic footprint. That's a lot of tax revenue. Like for the state of North Carolina, there's a lot going on. And then obviously the impact on lives around the world. We are an innovation hub. This is where people come as scientists, as researchers, because these are world-renowned institutions based in the state. And I ensure that, you know, I lift that message up. I work with media. I work with our representatives. I speak at events. I talk to this is my podcast, but
it is.
That's my first.
I am so honored.
So fun, but you know, people should see this state as a place that where they want to work, where they want to invest, where they want to bring their organization. When people from North Carolina go elsewhere and they talk about what a great state this is, they can say, "We have sweet potatoes, and we have hogs, and we have the mountains, and we have the ocean, and we have global health."
Yeah,
that should be on the list.
Yeah,
of things that every North Carolinian could be proud of.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You're making me like miss North Carolina so much. I spent like 8 or 9 years living there and loved it so much. I only left because I had a job in DC that was like a dream. But man, I loved North Carolina so much. So you all were unfortunately really affected by kind of the ripple effect of the cuts to U.S. aid. What happened?
Yeah. It's been a crazy couple months. Everyone listening probably knows that as of January 20th, the entire foreign aid, the whole global health sector, we all started getting just like hit after hit after hit from the stop work order all until July 1st, USAID was officially, you know, put under the State Department umbrella. And just thousands and thousands of people have lost their jobs in those months. And millions of people have lost access to life-saving programs in those months. And my organization we've really been in it. We've been in it. Also, North Carolina is home to many implementing partners that were funded by USAID. So we are actually the fourth highest impacted state by USAID funding. So when this happened, we lost billions of dollars. I think it was about $3 billion in funding that would have come to our state's economy in the coming years that just overnight disappeared, right? And so with that goes jobs, with that goes livelihoods. And we know that every single job that's lost, so we have a confirmed number of 550 North Carolinians who have lost their jobs as a direct result of USAID.
And probably more.
Yes. So that's what we've been able to confirm. It's very hard to track. I know it's more than that. I know it is. I also know that then with the, you know, double whammy of NIH and CDC cuts, we're going to see even more of folks who were partially funded here and partially funded there. And they're like hanging on for dear life. But come fall, suddenly we're going to see all these researchers not go back to their positions at the universities because they're not funded. Right. And like, there's going to be just so much more job loss in the coming weeks and months. So I've been, in it from the get go, working with our elected representatives to ensure that they understand this economic impact on our state.
That they can communicate it to their constituents as well.
Yes. And they can try to help
and
vote in a way.
Yeah.
There have been many opportunities for our representatives to vote to protect not just USAID. There's USAID, the like infrastructure of this, you know, agency, which is important. And I want people to continue talking about that. And also there's American investment in foreign aid. Right. And that can go through a number of different mechanisms, and people have lots of opinions about that. And I don't want to get into the details of that, but like just bare bones, America has money that it has given to make the world a safer place for other people and for Americans. This makes Americans safer to invest.
And health is like the perfect example of our interconnectedness, and borders, you know, cannot stop a virus, as we all learned during COVID. Yeah. And so really investing in other people is investing in ourselves.
Absolutely. And it's been 1% or less of the American budget for decades. Yeah. And, you know, it's just such a small amount of money to throw out millions of lives and hundreds of thousands of livelihoods. I'm still talking about it. Yeah. As we see NIH cuts, I'm really concerned about what this means for North Carolina as a center of not just global health, but a center of innovation, a center of medicine and technology. And I mean, this state has everything. We have life sciences. We have, all of that is at risk. This economic engine, that's, you know, primarily based in the Triangle, but honestly touches every corner of our state.
Yes.
It is really at risk right now. And that's going to hurt everyone in my state.
Yeah. Well, since I like to force us to end on positive note, I have a question for you that actually I didn't include in your list of questions. So hope you will forgive me for that. But also I feel that you have prepared for this for probably the past 15 years. So here's the question. Let's talk to the feds, because a lot of my listeners are still, feds who want to hear other public servants talking about their journeys and maybe even connect or resonate with some piece of those stories. Tell me what you would say to people who may have worked at USAID or the State Department or other agencies that have recently lost their jobs and are now looking for other opportunities. Why should they consider coming and working for maybe a state or regional organization on their topic of expertise, especially if they're working on health?
Oh, it's such a good question. And I, it makes me a little bit sad that we have to ask this question, because I wish that in our, honestly, like down to the foundation of our education systems, we taught our students in a way that allowed them to see these interconnections from the get-go, that domestic public health and global health are actually sisters, right? Yeah. And that there should be more of like bi-directional opportunities, bi-directional learning and collaboration between these spaces. And we've really siloed them, and people have a hard time overcoming that silo. It's in our brain. It's not just an infrastructure. It's like, these are siloed spaces in our brains. And so for someone, I get it. Like I had been working internationally and I only worked for large INGOs. I got my MPH in global health, and then I graduated and decided to work domestically. Mm-hmm. And that was a hard sell. That was I had to like rewrite my story to convince someone at the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services why I was the right person to serve North Carolinians. I was a new North Carolinian. I was not from here. And I had to convince them that my service to rural Hondurans would somehow translate to serve rural North Carolinians. And it did take some work. It also, it took some, you know, personal, like, inward work.
Yeah.
What is my story here? I had to rewrite that narrative a little bit, but I didn't have to rewrite it in a sense that it became inauthentic. I just had to rethink about what is the arc here and like, what are the connections I can make that maybe someone else didn't tell me? No, there aren't, unfortunately, there aren't really a lot of examples of how to do this, right? So we each are
But you're an example that I hope other people are now listening to. Like, you know, if you can see it, you can be it.
Yeah, I hope that people see that if they're looking at my story, and I switched or pivoted or whatever the language is that we're using, from international work to domestic work, and now back to, I'm in the global health sector. I actually serve sort of a domestic constituency in that I'm serving North Carolinians primarily. But my work, what I'm thinking about all the time, and the topics I'm engaging on, it's all in the global space. And I think about my global partners as much as I do my domestic partners. And, you know, that those like pivots, I think I struggle with this word pivot that we're all using right now, because that feels like a 90-degree turn, right? Yeah. And you're sort of leaving behind the road you were on. And I don't think that's what we're doing. And it's just, it creates a barrier in our own minds to think that we're either throwing out everything that we've done or sacrificing what we've done, or that it's going to be so, it's not going to be the journey that we had chosen, right? When really all of our journeys are like this. And you can go back and forth between these spaces. Their skills are transferable. People are actually in bodies everywhere on the planet. And so many of the challenges that we face are really complementary between geographic regions. It is challenging right now because there's a lot of onus on the individual to craft our own narrative, to make ourselves sellable to new spaces. And that's really hard. That's legitimately challenging. And also it is plausible. Like, it is plausible and possible. There are people out there who will see that narrative and go, wow, that's really endearing. Like, or that's really, like, we want those skills. And there's just so many ways to serve, right? Like, if your mission, go back to the question you asked me at the very beginning, like, how'd you get into this? Why'd you get into this?
Right.
Let's all do that work.
What's the part of you that you're really satisfying with this work?
Yes. And like,
what is it that you have to offer that is your special gift?
Yes.
And I also, because I have three little boys, can't help but think of this in terms of Lego. I feel that every experience that you have in life is like a new Lego brick that you're acquiring. And when we build these careers, like, we have put something together. Like, this is my Lego masterpiece. But sometimes if you want to make something new or you acquire new pieces, you have to take apart what you've built and you have to put them back together and incorporate something new. Yeah. And that's how I think about what you were just describing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I think that's really beautiful. And I think you're keeping the pieces, right?
Right.
Yes.
Your pieces. No one can take them from you.
Yes.
And maybe sometimes you're not going to use a couple of pieces in a structure that you built. That's okay too.
Yeah.
I think it's being open to the fact that it can change. And if you're creative, you have all the material that you need.
Yeah.
It's just about getting out of your own way and being willing to take apart what you built, which is really hard for some of us who like to build with a map. That's the other thing. Like, there are two kinds of Lego builders, those who love a map and those who want to build creatively. And like, I like to build with a map. And so when my kids get a new set, I'll help with that set. But as soon as they take it apart and want to do something from their own imaginations, which is amazing and I admire it so much, I like can't do it. I look at it and I'm like, I don't see it.
Like, what is that trash? Like, no, it's not.
No, I don't have the gift. Like, they will look at a pile of Legos and they will create something that's astonishing. Like, I don't know how they do it. I need a map. So maybe in my career I can be creative, but with Lego I'm not there.
Yeah.
But
fair.
You got to know yourself too.
Your framing of the pieces and like owning the pieces, I think, is really powerful. And, you know, I look at my story and there are a lot of people that might read my story and go, what is she about? Like, what is she trying to do? But maybe my mission is not going to fit within the box of what other people who came before me, how they framed their mission. I've always been really motivated to be close to the work, to be in community. And yes, I have these sort of like primary motivators of a healthier world and serving women in marginalized communities. But those are big picture things. You can do that in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And so I do try to, like, let's not limit ourselves to, well, this is the way that you serve women. No, there are people who are working in climate or in building roads who are, their mission is also to serve a marginalized community or to make the world a healthier place and they're building road. And like, that's really
powerful. You've gone and talked to Congress. You go and talk to churches that are probably really small. If I'm thinking of North Carolina, the way I remember it, like some really small, intimate church communities, like there is no one right place to do the work.
Yeah,
and I think you're such a powerful example of that. And I'm so thankful that you were willing to join me and have this meandering conversation today. You're a beautiful person, and I hope others will be as inspired by your story as I am, Brianna. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was so much fun.
It was a lot of fun. That's why we went over our time. All right. Thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you.